AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at rubrik.com. That's rubrik.com.
Welcome, everyone, to another episode of Kiwi Talks. My guest today is best known for directing Blood Omen, Legacy of Kain, Eternal Darkness, Serenity's Requiem, and Metal Gear Solid, The Twin Snakes, and is currently working on the upcoming Dead House Sonata. I'd like to welcome Dennis Dyack. How are you doing, my friend?
Doing great. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for agreeing to do this. I've noticed you do a lot of podcasts and interviews, so I'm going to try and switch this up a little bit for you in the beginning.
Cool.
Because you used to be a Taekwondo champion, right? You're into...
Correct. Wow, I don't know if I've ever been asked that before in a podcast. Yes, that is correct.
Yeah. So you did a lot of contact sports. You were doing wrestling. Was there any plan at any point that you wanted to go the route of being a wrestler, Canada's next Bret Hart? Or was it always video games?
Oh, that's a great story to talk about. I don't get to talk about this very often. So when I was in high school, I knew I wanted to make video games. And when I was doing like some computer courses, I got pretty much perfect on them, really excelled in it. But then at the same time, you're right, I was a Canadian Taekwondo champion. Couple times, actually. I think I got a gold and a bronze, and I can't remember, but
nice.
So it was full contact in the Taekwondo days, but I did Kung Fu, Jeet Kune Do, like I did like a bunch of different tons of martial arts, karate. I loved full contact sports, and I in my later days in high school, I actually started wrestling for the university team before I went to university, which was the local university is Brock University in Niagara. I live in Canada. A lot of people think I'm from the US, but I'm actually Canadian. And Brock University is pretty much the premier university for wrestling in all of Canada.
Wow.
So all of my friends are Olympians. A lot of them have done like UFC. A lot of the people that I used to wrestle with were like UFC champions. And so full contact sports was a big deal for me. And so when I was in high school, I got accepted at a really good university called Western Ontario for computer science and Waterloo, which is also a good school. And I got accepted at Brock, and I made the decision that I was going to wrestle instead of doing computer science, even though I wanted to make video games. So my first degree is actually in physical education, in which I was on the wrestling team. I did pretty well, but not as well as my friends. My friends are, like I said, Olympians, and they've done quite well on the sort of wrestling circuit. And then when I graduated from phys ed, I had just met Joanna at the time, who's now my wife. Our 30th anniversary is coming up May 29th. So it's very close. It's going to be 30 years soon.
Congrats.
No, thanks. Yeah, we dated for 7 years. So we've been together almost 40 years now. But back then, I was, well, what am I going to do? And I wanted to make video games. So I put myself through computer science, quit wrestling, and did computer science, then did a master's in computer science. So I actually have 3 degrees. And it all came from starting off as this full contact, working out 6 hours a day, totally into martial arts and sports and all I could do, to transitioning to, I guess, is a complete nerd and making video games. But I literally put myself through school in comp sci because I thought I didn't have the tools, and I was very afraid that I was going to get in over my head. But that's the story. So that's where all that background in martial arts come from. But yeah, so Bruce Lee and Enter the Dragon, I think I saw that in the theater, and this was back before you could just watch movies on TV, because I'm old now. I think I saw it in the theater at least 60 times.
Wow.
So every time it would come around, I'd go watch it. I'd memorize it. And that's why I took Jeet Kune Do. I had a really good instructor, and we talked about, you know, the philosophy of, you know, Bruce Lee's philosophy and stuff like that. So yeah, I'm huge into martial arts, and I still am today. And so between sort of action movies and horror films, and it's still my thing. So yeah, I don't get to talk about that very often. So thanks for that question.
No worries. Well, it kind of leads into my next question, because have you been able to utilize that martial arts or wrestling into video games somehow? Like whether you're directing an animator in terms of rigging an animation of a character of some sort?
In some ways, yes, but in a different way. So I'll say this. Yeah, to some extent, but not largely. No, we don't do too many fighting games, though our games are very action oriented and tend to lean towards, you know, the science fiction or supernatural area. So, you know, when you take something like, Metal Gear or like Blood Omen Legacy of Kain, it's a lot of research into the lore, and I'll sort of try to, back then, when we're creating Legacy of Kain as an example, because being involved in all these martial sports, I was always like, why would a vampire ever give up a sword? Like, I get that you're super fast, but why not use that sword to be even better? You know,
yeah.
Why not cast magic? And that sort of got me into Warhammer. I'm a big Warhammer fan. And in Warhammer, of course, all the vampires are, you know, military, and they use all of that stuff. Like, this is the kind of vampires that I want to create. And that's sort of one of the ways that sort of Kain came around in a lot of Elric stuff. But I think where it's really helped and had a massive influence on me is just the idea of perseverance. So wrestling is a really good example. So compared to any other sport that I've done, when you lose a wrestling match, you get beat up. It hurts. You don't like losing. It's not a sport that you generally, it's not like football. There's no cheerleading section. Generally, right. Members of the opposite sex don't watch wrestlers. You know, it's not like football or baseball, or so it's a very low prestige sport. It's really hard to train. You have to train a ton, and you get hurt all the time. And when you lose, it's really terrible. But what it does give you, and same with the martial arts, it gives you this level of perseverance and pain endurance. And that's what I would say for anyone who's going into the video game industry. I love making video games, but it's hard. It's really, really tough. And there's all kinds of sort of things that I always recommend to a lot of upcoming video game designers. But if there's one thing I would always recommend, is just survive. Do what you need to do to survive, because you cannot predict technology. You cannot predict the way the industry is going to go. But if you can survive, you'll eventually make something that you love. You'll get there. And that's kind of where I think sort of the wrestling and all the martial arts training came in, because, you know, you're training for the Olympic team and you lose by 1 point, and which is what happened to me. I was the runner up for the Canadian Olympic team when I was wrestling. And it's kind of like I was the bridesmaid a lot when it came to sports. And a lot of my really good friends, they did make the Olympic team, or, you know, some of them won some UFCs. And so they're pretty tough hombres. But just even hanging around those guys and getting beat up by them in a friendly way.
Yeah.
But it still really hurts. It builds character. And I think having that for video games is really important, because the industry is completely merciless, and fans out there, they don't like what you're doing. You're going to get it. So it helps that way.
Well, there's also a disconnect as well, right? Because I'm pretty sure a lot of gamers don't actually understand what goes on behind the scenes with what you guys do, right? There's a lot of pressure, a lot of anxiety, particularly I suppose near the end, where you'll have like a crunch period, I'm sure, where you've got a deadline and you've got to hit it. So in terms of martial arts, like, do you practice meditation or some other practices that result in removing the anxiety or de-stressing you somewhat?
Yeah, it's kind of funny that you ask these things. So I And I don't meditate very often. It's very rare for me. But I guess I kind of have a very Bushido mentality when it comes to a lot of things. And what that means is when you're going into a tough time, which happens often in the video game industry, it's completely opaque. People have no idea what it's like. A lot of people think it's fun and games, and it's really hard. You're competing worldwide. There's really no barriers. So when we create something, someone in Japan could be creating something better. Someone in, you know, Hong Kong, or, you know, somewhere in France, who knows where. It's just completely open, and there's thousands and thousands of games released every year. So it's extremely competitive. And what I tend to do, I guess, where I think the tenacity's really helped from the martial arts point of view, is there's this sort of samurai philosophy of what a samurai used to do before he would go out and do whatever samurais do, which is essentially police or be part of the, you know, part of the military. They'd prepare for death. So they just assume, okay, if I'm going to die, I have to get all my stuff in order. So when they would go into battle, they wouldn't fear death. And that's kind of a lot of things that I tend to do, is I just plan absolutely for the worst case, and like, okay, I've done everything I can, and then I don't think about it anymore. Then I just go in to win and to go in to, you know, do my job and, you know, make this game as good as it can be. And because you will hear, it's very, very easy to criticize. It's very easy to say that this is not going to work, because quite frankly, in the video game industry, there's way more failures than there are successes.
That's true.
And I remember Mark Cerny, who's a friend of mine, when we finished Legacy of Kain, we had an ongoing bet. His game is Crash Bandicoot. I lost the bet. I said Kain would do better than Crash. It did not, wow. But it still did well. And I said I would buy him dinner. So I bought him dinner. We went out for dinner. And one of the things he told me, it was very insightful and very thoughtful, was he's like, okay, you've had a hit. And now you need to determine if that was just luck, or you actually know what you're doing. So he's like, come talk to me when you have another hit. And I really took that to heart, because you do see in the video game and industry quite a bit, teams that will have one hit and they can't do it again. And there is timing and luck involved with everything, but there are groups that have several hits. And if you can make more than one successful title, like really successful title that people know, that millions of people know, then that to me is, you know, true success and true kind of, you know, that kind of focus. And so I'll always remember that from Mark. He's, you know, we worked together on Legacy of Kain back in the day. He was at Crystal Dynamics. And when we got that first PlayStation in, we had the first PlayStation in North America when we were working on Legacy of Kain. And all the instructions were in Japanese. And he spoke fluent Japanese. So he was helping us with that. And it was pretty cool. So anyway, just a bit of a story there.
Yeah. So with Eternal Darkness, because that's an odd one, because it was critically acclaimed as one of the best games on GameCube, but it didn't sell well as well, right?
Yeah, well, that's not actually true to an extent. So it sold really well from a penetration point of view, which means the number it sold compared to the console. So yes. I think it sold around a million, but the GameCube was Nintendo's worst selling console of all time.
At the time, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think it still is, but I could be wrong.
Wii U is.
Oh, was it worse?
Okay. Yeah. Far worse.
I haven't kept up, but so like I remember a lot of people saying, man, if that would have came out on the PlayStation 2, you would have sold like crazy numbers. But we didn't care. So from that standpoint, it's kind of, so my favorite movie of all time, or one of my favorite movies of all time, is John Carpenter's The Thing.
Ah, yes.
And right. I love that movie. I always have. I saw it when I was 15. So I kind of snuck into the show with a friend, terrified me. And it came out around the same time as E.T. and everyone was talking about E.T. And I don't know what it is with me, but I clearly like very dark horror. And that movie terrified me, but I was like, man, Why do people care? Like, E.T. was good. I remember liking E.T., but I was like, compared to The Thing, this is awesome. And The Thing did awful at the box office. And as a matter of fact, John Carpenter, who's one of my favorite directors of all time, he's seminal in a lot of the way I think about horror and creating things. He had a hard time getting like work after that. And I was just like, wow. And that turned out to be his most iconic movie, as far as I'm concerned. He's done a lot, like Big Trouble in Little China. He's done a lot of great work, in my opinion. But if Eternal Darkness ends up being the same in that way, so yes, we didn't sell 10 million units of Eternal Darkness, but I know so many people that consider Eternal Darkness to be their favorite game of all time, including many of the people I worked at with Nintendo on that project. We're very proud of it. And, you know, I think in many ways it was ahead of its time. We were talking about quantum mechanics. You know, what does replayability mean from, you know, multiple timelines? And, you know, we were doing Lovecraft before it was cool. Now it's almost popular culture now. And back then people didn't even know what Lovecraft was. So it was kind of fun. But yeah, so it's mostly the console, in my opinion, because I think we had like 33% penetration. So we sold one third of the consoles, and in some ways, maybe other titles, like some of the bigger ones, got over that, but that was just incredible, you know, penetration. And those were for titles that had done, have been around forever, like Mario and Zelda and all that stuff.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I wonder if a remaster in this day and age would cause it to sell a lot better. I mean, I was playing Metroid Prime Remastered recently, and it made me think. I was like, oh, Eternal Darkness would benefit so much from this. I think almost get like a second wind.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, I think so. There's not, you know, we started, so just going to Dead House Sonata just really quickly. We're making Dead House Sonata. We're doing a lot of crazy things. Some of the stuff we haven't announced yet, and we're trying to create the holy grail of sort of narrative and some of the things we're doing, but just sort of push that aside for now. More than anything else, we're trying to bring the voice of games like Eternal Darkness and Legacy of Kain that have essentially become extinguished.
Yeah.
Games like those are not being made anymore. And so that was one of the reasons we started working on Dead House. We're like, we need to make a game like that because no one's doing them anymore. So yeah, that's I do agree that I think it would resonate, and we do get asked all the time. It's a lot of fun stuff there. So who knows, maybe someday.
Well, I suppose even if it was allocated to some sort of third party studio or something and you oversee it, possibly. Because yeah, I know you don't have the bandwidth to do it now. I mean, it would be impossible.
You never know how things are gonna go in the industry. I learned that a long time ago. Back this is even pre-Legacy of Kain. Our first game that we worked on, I was heavy into, and this is just an example of how you can't predict things. The first game we did, I programmed in assembly code with a bunch of other people on the Atari ST and on the Amiga and on the PC. And back in those days, the Amiga was vastly superior to the PC. And the ST was pretty close. And it was kind of a, like, I still think technically the Amiga was the best system because it could multitask and did all these crazy things. And I thought, you know, there's no way the PC is going to win over these technologies. And it had nothing to do with the tech. It had to do with marketing and adoption. And so a lot of times, you know, we try to predict which way the industry is going to go. And it's, you shouldn't, because you just can't. And like even today, we don't know where things are probably going to go. We can kind of guess, but it's very, very difficult. So it's best just to go with the flow and focus on what you know and just keep creating the great games. And after that, my lesson learned was, okay, so I was totally wrong on all these hardware platforms. So let's just start creating games that the hardware platform doesn't matter. Just think of the medium, think what we can do, and let's create games in the medium as we best know how, which is how, you know, Legacy of Kain and Eternal Darkness and Metal Gear and all those games like that came about. So
how long did it take you to settle on the camera system that you have in Eternal Darkness? Was that
long time?
Yeah, yeah, because I imagine because you were inspired by Resident Evil. I know you love that game, and that played some part in it, I'm sure.
So here's the story to that. We're pitching a totally different game to Nintendo. We were doing some technology tests to show them that we could work on the N64. We were working on the N64 ahead of time, before it eventually went to the GameCube, but that's another story. And so we're doing some technology tests, and Resident Evil 2 came out, which is my favorite Resident Evil of all time. And I was flying down to Seattle to do the pitch. And I think Resident Evil came out like 3 days before I was supposed to
go. Yeah, that's right.
And so the pitch was ready. And me being very young and just being a gamer, I stayed up all night for like three nights in a row playing Resident Evil, and I finished it and I loved it. And I went to Nintendo, a wreck, basically. Our producer there, his name's Henry Cerchi, good friend of mine now. He just looked at me and he's like, dude, you look like hell. And I'm like, I know, I just stayed up for the last 3 days playing Resident Evil. And he's like, oh, isn't it awesome? And we started talking about it. And what I liked about Resident Evil, which really, it hadn't happened in movies yet. Eventually it came in movies, but you play the perspective of these different characters. And I love that. I was just like, hey, that's really cool. You play the story one way and then you see it as the character the other way. And that's what I really loved. And so it's like multiple characters in the sort of how you would see things through the eyes of different people. I thought that was really interesting. And so we're pitching this other project, and, you know, Henry and I were talking. He's like, dude, you shouldn't pitch. You look like hell. You just go home. And I did. He said, but why don't we do something like Resident Evil, but it can't be a clone of Resident Evil. It'll never get accepted at Nintendo. And I'm like, no. What if we did something like Lovecraft? And he's like, yeah, what's Lovecraft? And we started talking a bit about it. And I went away, came back like a few weeks later, had like a plot line with 12 different characters, which was the inspiration from Resident Evil in that sense. And it was horror, but it wasn't going to be survival horror. We thought that, you know, that they had done survival horror well enough. We didn't, that was their sort of genre. So what we wanted to do is tell some real narrative, try to keep things contextual. And then a lot of people don't know this, but I'm a big prescriber in academia and having academic foundations.
That's right. Psychology as well. Somewhat.
Correct.
Yep.
So we had a psychologist on staff, and we had a film expert on staff from the local university, and they were not full-time, but they were involved in the company a lot. They would lecture to the company when we were doing the sanity effects, as an example. John Mitterer, who was the psychologist, we did focus testing to see what the reactions were for the sanity effects, and we sort of worked on ways that we knew they would be effective. And then there was Dr. Barry Grant, who's still a good friend of mine, and we still go watch movies together. He was a film expert, and I said to him, we need to start analyzing film, and, you know, should we go back? Then there was a big push within Nintendo to go first person. And I wanted to know the film theory behind why, because film started out as first person. And a lot of people don't know this, but initially film was all first person. And then they went to third person to better tell story and to see facial expression. And I actually started asking those questions. And so we started doing research, and we got a whole team together and said, we want a camera system that allows us, because in film, to speak the language of film, because in film, dialogue, you don't need to be constantly explaining things through exposition. The language of film allows you to tell stories through upshots and downshots. And I felt very strongly that we could learn from the film industry, and we had an expert already with us. And so we developed that camera system, to really speak the language of film. And it was a hit. And after that, a lot of games adopted it. Like, like Assassin's Creed after a while sort of looked at it. I'm blanking on the other name. What's the big Sony game? I shouldn't blank on this. But a lot of games adopted it after that, where there's a smooth camera. It was a sort of third person. And we had to pitch this to Miyamoto-san. He was very worried that it was too complex. So the idea was, if we had an adaptive camera where it wasn't difficult to control, at the same time could be third person, it could be quite enjoyable and simplistic to the players. And we did a prototype. He loved it. And boom, Eternal Darkness went away from being first person to third person, which I was very happy with. So, God of War was the game I was thinking of. God of War did a lot of very similar camera things after Eternal Darkness came out. A lot of games did, frankly.
That's interesting, because Metroid Prime was first person. Well,
yes,
partly first person. So I'm wondering if that has something to do with that. Yeah. So because Nintendo, they're big more into prototyping rather than pitches, right? So do you spend more time, you do a basic pitch and then you get into the gritty stuff with the prototype to really sell the idea to them? Because that stuff would be hard to convey in words, I would think. I mean, you've done a pretty good job now. But it's better to show and tell. I would think.
It's a whole philosophy, and so I was told just actually about a year ago that people generally see me as a Japanese developer because of all these theories, and I'm a big prescriber to the Nintendo way. But let me explain it.
But you speak Japanese as well, though. That might have something.
I do. Yeah. I do. It's very rusty, though. It's very rusty, but. Yeah, I do, and I need to pick it back up, that's for sure. But there's sort of two schools of thought. There's kind of the Japanese sort of what I would say is development driven. So you have companies that are focusing purely on development, and then the marketing will come second. And then there's more of the Western way, which quite frankly is marketing led, and you'll see huge marketing budgets. And that's how it seeps into the development process as well. So as an example, we had a game design document this thick for Eternal Darkness. It was massive. It had the story. It had all the game design. It had the spell system, had the sanity system. We had all of that stuff in this massive document. And when we were pitching it in Nintendo of America, they wanted all that stuff. Okay, but... we talked about marketing and how it was going to go. When we went to Japan to get it approved, because that's where approval came from Miyamoto-san and the group there. First thing Miyamoto-san said is, I'm not reading anything. Give me a controller and I'll tell you if we're going to move forward, which is terrifying. But also at the same time, you have this level of confidence that, you know, if you do something good, they'll recognize it. And that's development-driven philosophies. There are few companies do that. Nintendo's one of them. There are others out there, but they're the rare exception, which I personally like. And that's why I still, to this day, even if you look at Dead House Sonata, first thing we did was a combat prototype. It's got nothing to do with the game, but here's the combat, and we got feedback from our community. We'll continue to go in that way, but it's very development-driven. Where a lot of the West is very marketing-driven, so a lot of games with literally... no foundation whatsoever, but all of these big ideas and big graphics and lots of money being spent and really good marketing campaigns and catchphrases. That's how most games are made. And that's very Western. So you have the marketing and the positioning of it, and the idea of the game supersedes everything. I'm just not that comfortable with that kind of thing. So I'm always about, you have to have a, sort of one of the rules that I learned very quickly, what you're doing the most in a game needs to be engaging, enjoyable by the player. So you start really small and you build up from it. That's very Japanese. A lot of other games, there's like, we're going to do this and we're going to do that. And there's no there's prototyping, but it's all
minor.
Yeah.
Well, it doesn't seem like a sustainable model, to be honest, to do it that way. But clearly, I guess it's working, though.
It does work. It's surprisingly effective. And what tends to happen is you get some good ideas that actually have a good development team, and those percent stick. And it's just the way the industry is. So there are way more failures in the West than there are in, say, Japan. But that's because in Japan, they'll prototype something out for a couple of years, and then once they're somewhere, they'll actually build it into a full title and go. That happens a lot within Nintendo, and a lot of things people don't know, where in North America, in the West, or in Europe, just tons of games get green light and tons of games get canceled, right? And you sometimes hear about them, sometimes you don't. But there will be, like, Call of Duty is a really good example of a very good dev team that came upon a really good marketing idea, and then boom, they all came together. Or Grand Theft Auto, another really good example of a really good idea with a good dev team. But a lot of the times, it's usually a good idea with a bad dev team, or a really good developer with a bad idea and some good market. But 90% of those will fail. And you just, you'll see when Nintendo comes out with a game, usually, I think there's a higher level of confidence from the consumer that it's going to be good. And that's because Nintendo cares, and it's their development philosophy brings that way. And those are the kind of things that, you know, I agree with too. And you see that from Sony as well, from their internal studios, you know, so you get a lot of that. And then where you have some of the Western companies like Microsoft, you're seeing just a ton of titles. Some will hit, some won't, but it's kind of like a mass, just a mass foray into just a ton of titles, a ton of development, where one is more quantity over quality is the way I would describe it. So, and neither are bad. I'm not criticizing either way. It just seems those are the ways that I would qualify the differences.
It's a good way of putting it. When you were working on Eternal Darkness, was there any plans to have more enemies, or was it just a case of budget? And because animation rigs are quite expensive as well, right? So to create a model and the animation rig is expensive, or it was then. So to extend it further.
There weren't more. No, not really. We didn't really have any limits that way. Gaming was very different back then. So don't forget, we went from the N64 to the GameCube.
Yeah, and then you had the whole 9/11 fiasco as well. So you went through peaks and valleys. It was a long tribulation.
Yeah, even with a super stable partner like Nintendo, the ride was still completely insane, and the project almost got canceled, right?
Yeah.
And it was very close to being... I remember right after 9/11 flying to Japan, it was $99 round trip, first class, and the plane was empty. No one was flying. It was insane. And it was... the world changed forever after that. And now you look at COVID, there's just... you can't predict things, right?
Yeah, so, yeah, that's right.
I would say Nintendo allowed us to do virtually everything that we wanted to do. And the only thing for scope that was maybe curtailed was maybe some intricate design stuff that really most people don't notice and only the people like me care about. But overall, and it was just because, so as an example, and they were just worried about permutations, and it was a quality concern, which, you know, I agree with and concur. I'm just super aggressive when it comes to some designs. So we limited what some of the enemies could spawn. You know, we had that summoner. In the final game, we limited what it could summon. I originally had a design so summoners were summoning other summoners, and it would just cascade into this crazy matrix of, if you don't kill them really fast, you're in big trouble. You're going to die. And Nintendo was very worried that that would just blow the scope out of the test schedule and we'd never get the game done. And when they tested, they wanted everything to be really solid. So I did concur with that. I would have pushed out the testing schedule by some of these things quite a bit. And so I was sad panda, but at the same time, I understood the scope. These are, in today's world where you can patch like instantly.
Yeah.
It would have been a different story, but back then you had one shot, right? It's, you maybe could do a patch, but if you did a patch, you're in trouble. And I don't think Eternal Darkness was ever patched. So.
So what is your relationship? Well, I suppose now with Miyamoto, and what was your relationship like with Iwata? Because he had a part to play in Metal Gear Solid, yeah. Right? And that becoming a thing.
Oh, yeah.
You. Yeah.
Oh, for sure. So I consider Miyamoto and myself friends, of course. I haven't seen him in a while. We're pretty good friends. And same with Iwata-san. Iwata-san was the first person I met from Nintendo Japan. And he came to Silicon Knights as a mysterious consultant. That's all we were told, is he was a consultant. And so he came down and he just wanted to, he stayed at the company for about a week or 2 weeks. And he was just doing everything. He was going through our business books. He was looking at development, just talking to the team members. Honestly, I was at the time, I had no idea kind of what was happening. And then he went back and he recommended that Nintendo buy Silicon Knights. I had no idea.
Really?
Yeah. And so that's how I first met Iwata-san. And again, I don't even think he was officially part of Nintendo yet. And then, so he recommended that. That all went forward and all that happened, which was awesome. And then suddenly he became president. And I remember sitting down with him and I was like, dude, what's going on? He goes, you know what he said? He's like, I know, really, huh? Surprise. And I was like, yeah. And he's like, it's going to be harder for us to talk casually. And I go, I get it.
Yeah.
Because suddenly he became the president of Nintendo. And frankly, that was how sort of Metal Gear kind of happened too. So we were, we had just finished Eternal Darkness, and I can send you a picture. I don't know if you have any images up on the blog and stuff, but I'm happy to send you a picture.
Yeah, send it to me.
Oh yeah, for sure. It's a very rare picture. I think you'll like it. I met Yamauchi-san. So there was like Yamauchi-san, Miyamoto-san, Iwata-san, a bunch of guys from Silicon Knights, a few others from Nintendo. We all got together in a picture, and that's when Yamauchi-san retired and Iwata was stepping up as president. So that's when all officially renounced. It was around my birthday. It was in July. And so we were there talking about another product. And once again, just like Eternal Darkness. And so the next day, so we got all those. It was really cool. I hoped I could meet Yamauchi-san at some point, and I did. I got a chance to meet him and speak with him a little bit. I was sitting down in the cafeteria at Nintendo in Japan, and it's this big open cafeteria. So, and I was just chilling, eating, and Miyamoto-san came down, sat beside me, and we were just talking. He speaks fluent English. His English is very good.
Really? And,
Oh, yeah.
A lot of people don't think that, because he speaks mostly in Japanese, so...
Well, it's good. It's good. He has Bill, who's awesome. Bill is always a translator. It can get tricky, right? It's not his first language. And because he has such an important role at Nintendo, but casually, if you're not talking business, his English is really good. And he's a great guy. It was really fun working with him. And so we were just talking, chilling, and I didn't think anything of it because this happened all the time when I was in Japan. A lot of people don't know this. He didn't have an office. He had a cubicle like everyone else. And I'd be often sitting in his cubicle. We'd be talking about gaming and stuff like that and philosophy and what the future of gaming is. But then Iwata-san came by as well. And he sat down with us. Then suddenly the whole cafeteria was looking at us. And I'm like, what is going on? And so then I think it was Miyamoto-san who said, hey, Dennis, what do you think about doing a Metal Gear? And I'm like, I almost choked. I did choke on my food. I was like, what? I was like, how is this possible? Sure, it'd be a lot of fun, but that's a Konami game. It's not a Nintendo game, right? And he's like, well, you know, I was talking to Kojima-san, and he really wants to work with us. But, you know, his team's really busy.
Yeah.
And he said if he had another team, that he would definitely do, like, a Nintendo exclusive for Metal Gear. And so I said to him, this is Miyamoto-san talking. I said to him, well, I have a really good team who's available for a project. And he goes, that's you. And I go, oh.
No pressure.
And I said, you really want us to do this? He goes, yes. And I said, okay, if you want us to do it, we'll do it. It'll be a lot of fun. He goes, well, that's really good because we're taking a bullet train tomorrow to Konami and we're going to sign the deal and we really want you to be in. I'm like, okay. And then boom, that's how Metal Gear started. So I came back, you know, to Silicon Knights after that. And I was like, okay, we're working on Metal Gear. And then I took like, I don't know, 15, 20 people to Konami a couple of weeks later. The whole team was in shock. It was a lot of fun. That making that game was also awesome. And Kojima-san is awesome. And it was really fun working with him too. So it was great. Those were good times.
So what were the internal discussions like in terms of deciding what to keep, what to improve on? Like the first person mode, for example.
Yeah.
How far in the development or did discussions take place?
Yeah. So one of the things to think about, and this is, it's really different than, again, Western developers. Why I love the sort of Japanese way of developing. First and foremost, you know, Kojima believes in this too, Kojima-san, is what is the experience we're going to give to gamers? So when we were doing this, we were like, we don't want to do a remake or just a port to the GameCube. It's a waste of everyone's time. So what kind of unique experience can we give Nintendo gamers for Metal Gear? So we wanted to combine the best worlds of what at the time was Metal Gear 2, because that's been out now, and Kojima-san was working on Metal Gear 3, but that was early in development at the time.
Mm.
And Metal Gear 1, so the story of Metal Gear 1 with the gameplay of Metal Gear 2 with cinema that's going to be, you know, totally different. And the impetus was to focus on quality and give gamers the best experience possible, not just to do, frankly, a cheap port, because Nintendo would have nothing to do with that. I don't think Kojima wanted to do that either. So, you know, at the end of the day, you know, Konami and Nintendo, everyone got together and we all agreed upon, here's are the pillars that we're going to do. And it was really aggressive, but it was really fun. And that's why I think, generally, I'm told this a lot from the super hardcore core Metal Gear fans, is that, you know, Twin Snakes was very, very different compared to the other Metal Gear Solid games.
Mm.
And the people liked it. It was a unique experience. And I'm glad for that. It was, you know, it definitely got some criticism for sure of being a little different, especially with the cinemas. But overall, it all came down to what can we do? And Kojima-san and myself talked about the first person thing. And he was like, do you think it'll make it better or worse? And we had a good discussion on this. And it really came down to, I think it'll be cool and better. Some people argue it makes the boss fights easier, which I think it's true. But it gives that unique experience that I was talking about initially. And I think that's why it won out overall. And it's those kind of discussions that you have that, you know, that I think make things stand out. And, you know, having the ability to make, you know, decisions like that, that hopefully will, you know, put the game over that tipping point that people remember it for, are the things that, you know, for me are the most exhilarating when it comes to game design.
Mm. There's a funny little Easter egg that I think is cool, where I think it's at the Otacon introduction and there's Mario and Yoshi on a computer screen.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you know, how did that come about? Was that something you thought of or someone within your team, or did Nintendo recommend it as an Easter egg? How did it come about?
I think it was kind of a collaboration on that. It's definitely someone came up with the idea, but everything has to be approved by everybody.
Yeah.
So, so you definitely can't get Easter eggs in like that without it getting approved. So everyone knew. And the whole idea about the collaboration was, let's get some unique Nintendo ideas in there. Let's get some unique, you know, I don't know if you've seen the Bernie pictures, like of Miyamoto-san, Iwata-san, Kojima-san, all us up there, you know, during some of the sanity effects and stuff like that going on in Metal Gear. that was all carefully coordinated. All the ghost pictures, all of those things were carefully checked by everyone. But the idea was, let's bring in all of these worlds together. Let's do this unique collaboration, which I think is one of the most memorable things about that project. When you think about it, you had three companies, you know, really working towards something very different that I haven't seen anything like that since. Getting three companies together to create a very successful project, in my opinion, it's just very rare. So it was kind of unique that way. And it was because everyone was very willing to cooperate, and it took a long time and it was very stressful, like everything else in the games industry, but it was pretty fun.
Do you have a most stressful project?
Ooh. Oh, they're all stressful.
That's a good answer.
I would say probably Eternal Darkness in many ways was probably one of the most stressful ones, mostly because I knew how good it was as we were developing it, and seeing it almost get canceled by geopolitical things that had literally nothing to do with us. And it was a really strange time where the arguments for being canceled were legitimate. They weren't just random. They were like, look, all this crazy stuff is happening. Should we be doing this? And then I basically had to make some huge guarantees that when we rewrote some of this stuff, that we'd do it clean, no one would be insulted, and that we could do it in a short period of time. Cause it was Eternal Darkness was on track to be a launch title until 9/11.
Yeah, that's right. It was.
Yeah. So we had to rewrite like one third or one quarter of all of the stories. And we had to strip out all kinds of graphics and change things around it. And, you know, cause we had a Crusader in there. And at the time, having a Crusader in there was not a good idea.
Particularly, that's that just time. Yeah.
Yeah. Just, you know, being too clever sometimes with historical. See, the idea with Eternal Darkness, of course, was, you know, these ancients are controlling catastrophes, and we had various different hotspots in the world that turned out to still be pretty hot. And so that's when, from a perspective of, you know, the content, we really had to be careful and fix it all up. But that was pretty stressful. It was 50-50 whether the game was going to get canceled. So it was pretty scary.
How do you keep up the energy and the motivation, particularly on a game like that where you've gone through, you know, the fact that it was going to be on the Nintendo 64, then it gets moved to the GameCube, so you have to start from scratch. Then the whole 9/11 thing. How do you prevent yourself from getting mental fatigue and just wanting the whole thing just to be over?
You know, that's going back to the early, that's going back to the martial arts and the wrestling.
Yeah.
That perseverance, that's where that stuff really helped me. And there's a bunch of sayings, like Winston Churchill had one that I strongly agree with. And it's like, I think the quote is, when you're going through hell, just keep going. And you know, I know this relative, like there's many worse situations in the world, but when it comes to your job and potentially seeing everything just come crashing down, the best thing you can do is just really focus and put one foot in front of the other and keep going. I don't know in the end, except what I do know is I love making games. I try to envision myself doing other things, like the martial arts. It's not like I can't do other things, but I just love it so much. And I love the ability to, I guess, give people catharsis and make them think. I've had so many people come to me and say, hey, you know, that plot line in Legacy of Kain, or what you did with Eternal Darkness here, and this kind of idea has really influenced, you know, me growing up when I was playing games. So that is better than any award. It's better, you know, those kind of things, because that's why I wanted to create video games. I was influenced in a similar way when I had these experiences. It was back with Ultima 3 back in the day. I remember playing that game and just going, wow, this is better. I was reading the Elric series at the same time. I remember it all very vividly. And as good as the Elric series was, one of my favorite stories of all time, it could not compare to that experience I got playing on the Atari ST, I think, on Ultima 3 with that membrane keyboard. Just that sort of interactive, that kept me going. And I would stay up all night playing it, lose track of time. Now it gets into engagement theory and all these other kind of things that we think really make people tick when they play games. And that sort of fuel keeps me going through these things, through these tough times, because I felt very strongly that Eternal Darkness was a game that needed to be made. Because back in the day, and still you hear it once in a while, but not very often, a lot of people thought game wasn't art, that narrative wasn't important. And I strongly disagree with those things. I think narrative isn't, I don't think it's everything. And I think there's different ways to make games. Some people focus on gameplay. Some people focus on artwork. Some people focus on story narrative. There's many ways to create a game. But I do think, just like, you know, coming back to why we're creating Dead House Sonata, narrative is something where I think really can help entertain people, and you know, that's what we do, we're entertainers, right? So anyway, so that's what keeps me going, just that feeling, that exhilaration, and knowing that when the game comes out, it'll all be worth it in the end. So
how hard is it to build a game around narrative though? Because like if you've got a gameplay oriented game, usually you can swap things and change things around as they go. When you've built an entire game around a narrative, then if you start changing the narrative around when you're partway through the game, then it means it creates a bit of a domino effect, doesn't it? Where you have to change a lot of other things.
Yeah, it's extremely difficult. And that gets, again, more sort of philosophy and schools of thought. There's sort of two schools of thought when it comes to creating narrative and story. And one is the traditional Hollywood Aristotle's approach of the three-act narrative. And then there's the other sort of approach was kind of like Tolkien-esque, where you do world building, you do a ton of world building. And then from there, you don't follow a three-act narrative. You build tons of detail up, and then you create, you know, plot lines once you've got that foundation established. That's a much rarer way of doing it. You see things like Tolkien or Babylon 5, or where sort of the background and the mythos almost takes a more important nature than some of the characters themselves. And that's the philosophy I take. And actually for creating games, you know, you combine that, my love for that type of style and that school of thought, combine that with computer science, where now we're getting into procedurally generated narrative, artificial intelligence. It's coming all into its own now. It actually makes it easier. So if you're to create a three-act narrative and something in gameplay doesn't work out, you're in big trouble when it comes to that. But if you create this awesome base, which is what we did for Eternal Darkness, we created all these gods, we created these pantheons, and we had the story laid out for sure, but it was done in such a way that it could change. And that's how we were able to rewrite it, because we're like, well, we've got these rules established in our universe. We don't have this plot that rules everything. And that typically is what happens with the three-act Aristotle sort of approach, where if you sort of go the Tolkien way, it's much harder. It takes a lot longer, but it gives you a foundation for not only sequels, but just the world building itself really helps. So I think, but that's why these games are so rare, because it's really hard.
Yeah,
It's much easier to do the Aristotle's way, because that's where most Hollywood writers come from. And most writers are very familiar with that. We're doing it the other way. You basically do years of research, building this foundation to even before you can even come up with the basic storyline that may adapt and change. So that's why they're so difficult. It's because it's very hard work. And it's, despite what people think, it's like 1% inspiration and 99% perspiration. You've got to do a ton of research. Like we've done so much research for Dead House Sonata. You know, we know how many different categorizing all the different types of undead. We've been going through chronologically doing all these things and like thinking about different houses. Well, one of the things people don't know about Dead House is, and it's a huge game, we're starting out with the House of the Dead. It's called Dead House, but there's eight other houses. There's going to be different types of hierarchies. And
oh, wow.
Yeah. So, and we're creating a really grim world where it's better off to be dead than alive. So we've got all these backgrounds and stories and hierarchies of the gods and why all this stuff is happening. And if you go to, and I'm using this as an illustrative example, it may seem like I'm trying to pump our game, which I do automatically, but it's really so to give people an illustration of what I'm talking about. We have hours of radio plays already that are outside of the main core of the game, just to give people an idea of the universe and the foundation that we're creating. So by the time people play the game, they will rest assured that the plot lines and the stories are going to be very well developed. And it should be, hopefully, if things go well, knock on wood, an extremely engaging experience for everybody plot wise. So yeah, so the answer is they're hard.
But have you set a limit to yourself and the team in terms of Deadhouse Sonata, in terms of, because obviously you can constantly keep getting ideas and keep building on this thing, right? Just keep going and going. So do you have to hone it in somewhat at some point and be like, okay, we're not going to add any more to this specific segment in terms of world building or animation or whatever?
Well, yeah, you do that, but the great thing and why I like free-to-play games and why this is our first, sort of my first free-to-play, but we've got like our COO who came on, Paul Rogozinski. He helped launch Warframe. He was at Digital Extremes for 12 years. He worked on Metal Gear with me. We've worked together for 10 years. The free-to-play space allows us to iterate once we've launched. So it's completely the opposite of, say, Eternal Darkness, where we had no patches, we launched it, and that was it, and then we went on to the next one. That's kind of like the typical AAA product launch. And the free-to-play model allows you to iterate with your audience and your basically the community. And so we have an idea of where we want to get to launch. We have this whole concept of ages, and it's a whole other thing we can get into. But the idea is we're going to present narrative in a very different way than what people have seen before. And a narrative in a sense that, if you look at Legacy of Kain, is a really good example of this. A lot of people have asked me kind of, well, what's your thing? Like when you create a game, what a lot of people think it's story, which I guess is true to a certain extent for sure. But I don't think that story, my background's computer science. I've gotten better at writing, I hope. But I'm a computer scientist at heart. When it came to Legacy of Kain, the vision there was, I played Ultima 3 and many of these RPGs, Final Fantasies, which I love. What I hated, I mean hated, was having to read text on a TV that was back then very pixelated, very hard to read. Your eyes got sore. Very poor medium for that. So we looked at Legacy of Kain. PlayStation 1's company's got this new technology called a CD-ROM. And for the first time, we could have voice acting. And so the vision for that game was no text. Everything is going to be voice acted by professional actors, which back then, I think we're either one of the first, if not the first, we're very close to the first Metal Gear when it launched. And Kojima-san used many of the same voice actors we did.
Hmm.
And so we took the medium and we basically said, what can we use with this medium to propel narrative forward? And that's exactly where we are now with Deadhouse. And there's been titanic changes. So now we have insane advances in artificial intelligence. A lot of people don't know this, but my background from my master's was actually in neural networks and user interfaces. So Fantasy Empires, which was the second game I worked on, and I think it launched in 1992 or 93. It just became available on Steam, ironically. But we implemented a learning neural network in that. And back then, no one cared. It's hilarious. But today, we can now utilize the cloud and the internet, and we can start using procedurally generated narrative and AI and start creating things that people never thought possible before. And we're so excited on where we can take narrative and story. And man, we got a ton of crap or shit, when we started first talking about Deadhouse Sonata. you know, a few years ago. And the first thing I got back was free-to-play game, narrative, that's an oxymoron. Get out of town. Get lost. Don't talk to me. People were like, do a single-player RPG, and you've got my money. They're like, now what do we want to do? And I actually, it's funny and true at the same time and maybe sad, but being a creator, you either stick to your guns or you don't. We were offered by one very big group, if we changed Dead House Sonata, change it from a free-to-play game into a premium, they'd take it right away and we'd have a big budget and the publishing deal would have been done a couple of years ago, several years ago, pre-pandemic now.
Wow.
And we said, no, we don't think it's the things that we're talking about now. We really believe in, we really believe that the free-to-play model is the best for narrative. And I'm looking forward to showing people what we mean by that in the next few years. So stay tuned on that. But we've got a lot of exciting things to announce on it. But yeah, so if you're looking for some radical narrative and narrative in a way that's never been done before, we think Dead House is going to be one of the games to look at in the future. So.
So I suppose you'll be able to utilize in the future ChatGPT in a way for narratives to help. I mean, a lot of people are talking about plagiarism and copyright and all that stuff, but it's a tool at the end of the day, right, that you can use to just give yourself more time to do other things if it can just fix a few things in terms of a narrative, I would think.
Yeah, it's funny. Recently had a call with some business people. I'll just say business people. They leave it totally, totally anonymous. And then these business people we were talking to, everyone's enamored by AI. And like all new technologies, people don't tend to not understand technology. If anyone wants a reference, I recommend this book series. It's very old now. Still a very good read, easy read, called The Real World of Technology by Ursula Franklin. I strongly recommend people check it out. Probably read it in a couple hours. And it talks about the social effects of technology. And the mistake that people make is they think that technology saves you time. There are millions of studies now that show that that is absolutely not true. And as a matter of fact, it's the opposite. What happens is technology allows us to do more, but it also takes more time. So as an example, 100 years ago, if you and I were to communicate, I would send you a letter, you would send one back, right? And we would not be able to communicate as much. But the amount of time that you spent writing that letter to me and I spent writing to you would probably not even be an hour that we're going to do in this podcast. But now the bandwidth has expanded. We're now communicating very fast in real time. We're recording all this. It's going to go up as a podcast. You're going to reach millions of people, but it takes more time. And all of this technology and all the things that we did to set this up requires tremendous investment. So this AI, all these AIs coming out where people, there's a vast belief out there, particularly in the investment community, that someone's going to be able to push the magic button and say, I'm going to magically create a story-driven RPG with ChatGPT and all these other things. That's absolutely not going to happen. And anyone who's going to start engaging in ChatGPT and all of these other new artificial intelligence technologies, which I think they're really awesome, they need to prepare that it's going to take them way longer to make a game that way. If they're going to do it right, they might be able to push out some crap that's going to be just garbage, because if you play with ChatGPT, yes, it will scan Wikipedia and give you quick answers. But if you actually try to have an in-depth conversation or really dig down, you realize very quickly it's only surface material it's giving you. So the trick is going to be combining what we know and how AI as a tool, very much like you said, can help us all out. And so games are going to take longer. They're going to be more expensive, but they're going to be way better because of these technologies. That's the way I look at it. And sorry if I cut you off. I get super hyped.
No, it's all right. Well, that's a good place to wrap up. I could talk to you for hours on end, but I know you need to get back to work and work on Dead House. So
thanks.
I look forward to seeing it when it's out. So a few years away still?
Yes. It's not coming out anytime soon. So sorry for any of the community that's listening, but we've been very upfront. We told them at the beginning of last year that it's not coming out this year. That's definitely it's not coming out soon. However, when it does come out, it's going to be worth the wait. That's our goal. So
yeah. Well, what's that Miyamoto quote? A delayed game is good, but a bad game is forever bad, or something like that. I'm messing up the quote.
Yeah, a delayed game. I can't remember it, but basically it says delaying a game is never popular, but a bad game, releasing a bad game is forever. And that was actually on one of the posters for Eternal Darkness. Because don't forget, we had to delay it for a couple of years and then it got delayed because 9/11. And so, yeah, we actually had that in our office. We had like an Eternal Darkness poster with that quote on it.
Wow.
Because it, again, to get through those tough times, right? So,
yeah. So if anyone wants to stay up to date with everything regarding Deadhouse, where's the best place for them to do that?
DeadhouseSonata.com. So Deadhouse, house is in the German spelling. So H-A-U-S, Sonata.com. And there's our Discord you can jump into. We generally try to release things just to keep the community up to date, but it's still got a ways to go, everyone. So it's not releasing anytime soon. So just hold on to your hats though and check it out. And you know, we're often on the Discord and I'll answer questions. Other people on the team will answer questions. So we love all feedback, good or bad. So, you know, feel free to jump in and give us your feedback.
Cool. Was Sonata a callback to Requiem, by the way? Because they're both musical references. So I was wondering.
Probably subconsciously.
Oh, some level.
Yeah, there's the whole thing with a sonata. When it comes to creating and telling a story, the structure of the sonata, the classical sonata, I think you combine different ideas that eventually come out with this sort of cathartic outcome. And there are some musical aspects with Deadhouse Sonata. Like there's a blood chant when you're the vampire and you start going faster and quicker. And the Lich, as an example, is, so I'm going to geek out here, but I love this stuff. The Lich, when they're casting spells, I should say, are, it's going to be like music, and it will be these chants and songs. And I guess the idea is I'm a big fan of cyclic history, and there's old, very old Egyptian manuscripts that talk about the ancient priests levitating stone and some of the ways that they, because no one knows how they built the pyramids, and people speculate the pyramids are much, much older than what we think they are, like 20,000, you know, we went through a cataclysm, all those kind of, I love that kind of stuff. But there's old manuscripts that say the priests of Egypt used to sing to levitate the stones and cut the stones. So this kind of idea resonates for me. And we wanted to create a story where music and some level of that, even though that everything is very dark, will resonate in such a way with all cultures. And I don't know if you've ever noticed this, but this is something I find very unique. We speak English and we have our accents, but if you sing, all the accents go away.
Yeah, that is true.
That is very true. Interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
So I think there's that common idea of music bringing people together in that sense. And so that's why in many ways, the House of the Dead is going to bring the world together in a way that people never thought possible. That's kind of the overarching story, but it's a big story and there's a lot to come. but that's where that all came from. That's kind of, maybe I was spilling too many beans there, but the project is very ambitious, and we do want to make people really, and we're not going to preach to anyone. And our goal is not to tell people how they should think, but we want there to be so much meat on the bone that when people experience Deadhouse, they'll be like, oh, okay, there's a lot here. you know? So anyway, that's where the name came from. And that's where Sonata came from.
Well, hey, I will wrap up there. Thank you again. I wish you all the best. I hope this is a massive success after the peaks and valleys you've been through. I think this is well earned. So I look forward to seeing it in a couple of years.
Awesome. Thank you, sir.
All right. That is the show, everyone. Make sure you share, like, and subscribe. And until next time, stay safe.